Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Malika Magner, attorney registration number 27149, on behalf of the appellant Jordan Ellis. In this case, the sentencing court erred in imposing upon Mr. Ellis a sentence that is a virtual life sentence, one that will likely ensure that he will die in prison. However, since this case involves a term of year sentence, and this question is pending before the Colorado Supreme Court in a number of cases, including Renfrew, Rayner, Lucero, and has been extensively briefed, I'd rather save my time to address the issues that I believe would be particularly helpful to this court. Particularly, the trial court also erred in denying Jordan's Batson challenges to two prospective minority
judges. Ms. Magner, let me interrupt you before you move on to that, because I do want to ask you about the first piece, and I know you want to focus on that, the other issues. So in this case, Mr. Ellis got life with the possibility of parole in 4 years for killing one victim, and got 32 years for attempted murder of a different victim. So I'm just curious whether that makes a difference. Cases like Rayner and life deal with a lengthy life, a de facto life term maybe, against one victim. Here we have stack sentences against two different victims. Doesn't that make a difference? Because let's take a hypothetical. We have a juvenile who kills 20 people. I mean, I don't know that a Supreme Court would say you can't sentence him to 10 years for each of those 20 people because it would be 200 years. So does it make a difference here that we're talking about stack sentences against two different victims?
Well, Your Honor, I am the counsel in the Lemkuhl case, and actually that was more than one victim for which he was sentenced. But whether it's one victim or 10 victims, the issue actually is, what is the appropriate sentence for a juvenile who the U.S. Supreme Court has made an unequivocal determination must be sentenced differently than an adult?
Sure, but does, and maybe I'm not articulating, and I apologize if I'm not. In this case, in Lemkuhl, there were more than I mean, I don't know that case, no more than one victim, but I think the individual victims added up to, well, in that case, I think the holding was, even if you add it up, there's a chance that the juvenile would get out before life was up. In Rayner, take that one, it was 256 years, and I remember total 128 years against each victim. I'm not familiar with a case that deal in this context that deals with stacking of sentences against different victims. And so is it your position that when you look at the total sentence, no matter how many victims, and life, a de facto life without parole sentence would be unconstitutional? You can take my hypothetical, it's 20 victims, and the juvenile gets 10 years apiece for murder of 20 people. Is that an unconstitutional sentence?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe that it is, because the analysis does not turn on the number of victims or even actually the heinousness of the crime, because as, of course, in Miller, the crime was very heinous, but it's actually based upon the characteristics of the individual juvenile, his or her inability to make the same kind of reasoned decisions, their increased capacity for change and reform, etc. So the analysis doesn't turn on the number of victims.
Ms. Magner, let me ask a different question about Lemkuhl. That case did not involve a homicide, is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, well, Graham has some language that suggests that homicides are different in nature from non-homicide offenses, and Miller did not necessarily prohibit a life without parole or a homicide as long as it was justified. And so doesn't the fact that this is a homicide with two victims make it different from Lemkuhl substantially so?
Your Honor, the court in Miller did make specific rulings and holdings that what they were talking about juveniles was not crime specific. Therefore, it's the position of the defense that these issues regarding this very fundamental capability of a juvenile and their culpability is not crime specific. A child who doesn't apprehend the risks, who is more easily led by their peers, etc. It's no different if they pull the trigger and someone dies or they pull the trigger and someone doesn't die.
Let me ask you about the life expectancy. What factors do you think the trial court is supposed to look at to determine an individual's life expectancy?
Right now, the court is looking at the statutory mortality table that is set forth in Title 13. As to the other factors, I think the focus needs to keep returning to whether a child is capable of rehabilitation or not. And as the court, as the Supreme Court said, the chances, the occasions where a child will be irrefutably incorrigible are rare. So
well,
it's not
that has
really
to go with the ultimate sentence, whether the sentence is appropriate or not. But I'm not sure how culpable a juvenile is has anything to do with their life expectancy, which would determine whether it is a life without parole functional equivalent or not.
Well, the issue is whether they should be sentenced to the ultimate sentence, which is no possibility of ever living their life or ever demonstrating their rehabilitation.
Right, but how do we know that we've hit that point without a determination of what their life expectancy is?
Well, the sentencing court should be taking evidence and reviewing the various information that the expert should be giving.
Ms. Magner, let me follow up on Judge Gores' question. One of the main points in which your brief and Mr. Michael's brief disagree is with what life expectancy table, if any, should apply. And you refer to Section 1325.102, which refers to individualized factors of the person. There's also reference to studies about the life expectancy of inmates, U.S. Census Bureau tables, Center for Disease Control tables. So if we were to follow the basic holding in Rayner and Lenkuhl, how would we or how would a trial court determine what the life expectancy should be given all of those factors?
Well, the issue, as I see it, really is that there's so many different ways to look at life expectancy that it really is a challenging question. The mortality table sets forth one, the CDC table set forth another.
Well, we know that it's a challenging question. We want to know what your answer is to that question. So do you have any thoughts as to how either we or a trial court should determine how Mr. Ellis's life expectancy should be determined for this specific case, given all of the different factors or different alternatives that there are that I mentioned?
What I think the most appropriate remedy would be for a defendant, a juvenile defendant, to receive regular reviews, so that rather than spending 40 years without the possibility of parole and then having the option of being considered for parole, I believe it's California that has now is requiring regular reviews. I think they're Californians every 15 years.
Well, isn't that a matter for the legislature instead of the courts?
It is a matter for the legislature. And in fact, what we're really talking about here is this issue of whether or not these two sentences, because right now Mr. Ellis has these two stat sentences that combined establish a virtual life sentence. So we're need to have one and not the other. And the problem in Mr. Ellis's case is that the sentencing court believed it was required to impose these sentences consecutively, even though the direct file statute had been amended to specifically exempt juveniles from the mandatory sentencing provisions of the sentencing chapter, and to say that for certain enumerated crimes, that a juvenile is not subject to those same mandatory provisions. So while the court thought that it was required to impose these mandatory sentences, it was not so required. And for that reason, We're requesting that the case be remanded for a new sentencing.
Did the defense point out the exception from the mandatory nature, the statutory amendment? Did they point that out to the trial court?
What the defense pointed out to the court was all the provisions of the new statute, filed a motion, asked that the provisions of the new statute be applied, and the sentencing court denied it.
Well, let me ask on that. Let's assuming that we would agree with you on that the new statute applying, doesn't it accept out, on this, it does say juveniles are excluded from mandatory minimums, and then it says unless it's a conviction of a class one felony. Don't we have a class one felony here, or did I misread the statute?
Well, the way that I read the statute is that because Mr. Ellis was convicted of an F1 felony, he is required to be to have the mandatory sentencing provisions for the F1 felony be imposed. However, what is at issue is the second conviction, the F2, and that because that is one of the is not one of the enumerated exceptions, the F1 and the sex offenses, that he was not required to be sentenced.
Thanks for the clarification.
And I see that I have less than 5 minutes left, and I didn't address my Batson challenge, but I would just urge the court to review the record with respect particularly to prospective juror Ms. G, who was struck for supposedly sleeping and upper body language. And actually, the record shows that she was not sleeping.
Well, if the prosecutor honestly believed that she was sleeping, isn't that what matters? Not whether she was actually sleeping or not?
The prosecutor did not say that he believed that she was sleeping. What the prosecutor said was that his detective later told him that he was sleeping. What the prosecutor actually said was that the reason that he my point is, if she was sleeping or if she didn't give any responses, I think that's a pretty good reason to strike her, because I don't know what her feelings are on the jury, when in fact she had spoken extensively. However, she had spoken to defense counsel, and the court appeared to be mixing up the basis for challenging another prospective juror with Ms. G, because the court said, well, the answers Ms. G gave are basically the same as the ones Ms. M gave, except the prosecution had not given as a reason for his strike that the answers given by Ms. G were inappropriate. So I'm going to save the rest of my time unless the court has any further questions.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Magner. You have 2 minutes and 38 seconds.
Thank you.
The court. My name is Joseph Michaels, attorney registration number 40403, appear today on behalf of the people of the state of Colorado. This case, I believe, is much more simple than it appears. I'm going to go through each issue very quickly, and then I'll go in and break down any issue that this court has questions on. But the reason I think this case is significantly more simple is because, in the first place, Miller does not apply at all, except for one small aspect, and that's because it's a homicide case, which means that Graham does not apply at all. And even if Graham does apply, then under the rubric set up by this court in Rayner and Lempool and Lucero, Mr. Ellis has the reasonable possibility of parole within his lifetime. The reverse transfer hearing statute is not retroactive, and it also does not apply in this case. And regarding the third issue, the Batson issue, the trial court made numerous findings that were all supported by the record. It made four with respect to juror G, each of which is supported by the record, and at least one of which was not even challenged by the defense counsel below. And on top of that, the trial court made specific credibility findings based on the prosecutor's demeanor and presentation.
Let me ask you a question about the juror G findings.
Sure.
The court apparently articulated thought that her answers were substantially the same as the other juror that was stricken, but that wasn't one that was offered by the prosecutor. Is that correct?
I think that's correct, but that's not necessarily, that doesn't mean that it's an error, because if you actually look at the facts of Juror G's response with respect to Juror M's response, they are very similar. They're both suggesting that that based on their answers, they would be sort of defense-oriented witnesses, and they would excuse.
Right. But I guess my question is, in a Batson challenge, you're not really evaluating the reason at the credibility stage. You're doing that on the race-neutral stage. Here, it's the prosecutor's, you know, credibility as far as the reasons proffered. And so if the prosecutor doesn't proffer a certain reason, is it proper for the trial court to basically offer a different reason?
It is in this context, because it's an ongoing discussion of what the juror's response was and how the juror presented herself to the prosecutor and what reasons the prosecutor could have and what reasons are supported by the record. What we're looking at with Batson, there are a number of factors, and I know this court's aware of all of them, but you look at the prosecutor's demeanor, the prosecutor's credibility, and whether the record supports the strike as for not being a pretextual reason. And here we have that. In addition to the trial court saying, and the trial court's finding was essentially, and I also acknowledge that Juror G's answers reflect the same basic problem that the prosecutor just articulated in the immediately preceding challenge to Juror M, which is that this particular juror would be more apt to excuse the defendant's conduct based on history, growing up, and childhood. While we're on this, and before I go back to the Miller-Graham issue, because I'm sure you have questions for me as well on that, I do want to emphasize that the prosecutor talked about four different reasons. He said, my investigator told me that she was sleeping on two different occasions. He said, I didn't talk to her, but that's not because I was going methodically, I was jumping around. Now, in defense counsel's reply brief, Ellis talks a lot about how, the prosecutor saw her and didn't say anything, but that's not exactly how what would have happened. What would have happened is the prosecutor would be posing questions at large to the veneer, and if Juror G is sleeping, then or not paying attention, then Juror G is not engaging with the prosecutor's questions. And so when the prosecutor is jumping around, the prosecutor is alighting on somebody who raises their hand or makes a comment or makes a response. The fact the prosecutor didn't talk to her doesn't mean that he even saw that she was sleeping. But it still articulates a race-neutral reason in the first place, and two, one that the trial court specifically credited based on the prosecutor's response and demeanor. I want to talk about the body language issue, because the prosecutor also said this juror is suggesting between her body language and her general attitude that she doesn't want to be there. Defense counsel never responded to that. Under People v. Robinson, a case out of this court, we have language that suggests that a defendant's failure to attempt to rebut a prosecutor's stated reason in response to a Batson claim can be regarded as acquiescence in liability. And there are a number of federal cases that agree with that, including one from 2014 that says the exact same thing. When none of the prosecutor's demeanor-based explanations are challenged or rejected by the record, then they're assumed that the defendant acquiesced to them. And so I think we have that here between those two alone. But we also have that a number of other Hispanics stayed on the jury, and that there were no race issues in this case. The other thing is the prosecutor, and the record's a little unclear about whether this actually happened. The prosecutor said, look, my trained observer saw her sleeping. He wrote down his notebook, and he said, here's the notebook, here's the proof is in the pudding. It's unclear whether the trial court actually looked at that notebook, but certainly it could have that explanation, and certainly that notebook seemed to have had that. Unless there are any other questions on the Batson issue, I'm going to go over to the first issue of Miller and Graham.
Can I ask you, Mr. Michaels, I just don't want you to run out of time, I would be appreciate if you would address this issue of stacking sentences when you've got two different victims. I feel probably pretty sure you don't agree with the stacking of victims and same victim, but let's assume that we're there on the law, that if you could have a de facto life without parole sentence on one victim would be unconstitutional. Just assume that for my question. Why would it be different if you had two victims or three victims?
I think there's a policy reason why it would be different with two victims. And the reason is, essentially, if you disallow stacking when multiple victims are at issue or have been impacted by a crime, then you're essentially discounting the crime. And you're discounting the victim's response to the crime. and you're basically discounting repeat criminal behavior. And we don't really want to do that because it doesn't reach a disincentive for a criminal defendant to cease and desist after one crime or after one victim, instead of saying, well, I'm a juvenile, so after I commit three burglaries against one person, I might as well go off and commit three burglaries against another.
Mr. Michaels, how is that consistent with the rationale of the Supreme Court decisions in Miller and other cases that focus on the nature of juveniles and their inability to appreciate their conduct?
I think it's important to look at Miller and Graham specifically, and Roper by extension, in the context that they're talking about. And our Supreme Court just weighed in on this last Monday, which I believe was June 1st. And they basically said, these considerations are all considerations when imposing the ultimate punishment. In Miller, it was life without the possibility of parole, and that was it. And the Tate decision of our Supreme Court was very clear that the only thing Miller talks about, and all this conversation about juveniles are not as culpable and juveniles have different characteristics, that goes into play when you're imposing an ultimate punishment. So when you're imposing life without the possibility of parole, you have to take those into consideration. But everything else is still, it doesn't violate Miller and it doesn't violate Graham. Miller only talked about no life without the possibility of parole, and it only talked about it for one singular offense. Graham, to shift gears a little bit, doesn't even talk about homicide. In fact, its concern is that at that point, the most extreme punishment for somebody who had not committed a homicide offense was life without the possibility of parole, which it deemed was categorically incorrect. But it was dealing with one singular offense, and it was dealing with non-homicide offenses.
Well, when you say Graham didn't talk about homicide, that's not exactly right. Didn't Graham talk about the difference between a non-homicide and a homicide combined with a non-homicide?
It did talk about that to a certain extent, but it's also talking about, its focus was this idea of the ultimate punishment, life without the possibility of parole, for a singular non-homicide event.
Right, that is the primary focus, but the court seemed to have, maybe it's dicta, but the court seemed to have some recognition that when you combine a non-homicide with a homicide, that it's a whole different ballgame.
And I think if that's the case, it certainly didn't issue a specific holding about that, and that case is not in front of the Supreme Court, it's not even pending in front of the U.S. Supreme Court at this time, but it certainly allows that if there's a homicide followed by subsequent events, and we're talking about non-homicide events, it's permissible to start talking about these more extensive sentences. Graham was talking very specifically about this mandatory life without parole sentence for a non-homicide offense, but when you start putting on extra sentences and extra crimes, then you have to do something with those, or else you essentially are sentencing for one crime and the rest of it falls by the wayside.
Mr. Michaels, in your brief, you said that you disagree with Rayner and other similar cases. Is that still your position today?
That is my position, and I realize I'm on a shaky ground, and with all due respect to the author of these opinions, I know you're all you're all very up to date on them. Graham, simply
that was very deftly handled, Mr. Michaels.
Graham simply doesn't require the expansion that Rayner and Lemkuhl all dealt with. And Lemkuhl is a different beast entirely than this case, because Lemkuhl, as I think each of you pointed out with the opposing counsel, Lemkuhl didn't address homicide offenses at all. And that, I think, is a very big difference than what we have here. Rayner did address homicide offenses, but it didn't necessarily suggest why Graham applied to homicide offenses, when in fact Graham really limited its holding to non-homicide offenses, despite conversations to the otherwise. This idea of the spirit of Graham and the spirit of Miller requiring all these specific individualized circumstances, it goes much far afield than what Miller and Graham actually hold, and our Supreme Court recently just sort of reaffirmed that by saying, in the Tate opinion, and Tate, Banks, and Jensen all together, of course, by saying, all that conversation falls by the wayside when all we have, the only holding, is that in order to impose a specific sentence, you consider that. But otherwise, those aren't dispositive factors, and they're not required necessarily to impose sentences that are not life without the possibility of parole. And here we have something that's very different. We have multiple sentences altogether for multiple crimes. I also want to suggest very tentatively, and then run away from this topic as fast as I can, that the Supreme Court, our Supreme Court, granted cert review in 5 of these cases. And each one of those cases, the cert question was framed not in the manner of did Rayner, did Lemkle, did Armstrong, did, I know I'm forgetting, Lucero, and one which I can't recall off the top of my head, did they err, did the Court of Appeals err by expanding Graham? So there seems to be this real idea that those four cases took Graham by its general, very narrow holding and expanded it. And Graham didn't deal with term of sentences at all. It dealt with the single imposition of a life sentence. It looked, its underlying data was very limited to, I think it was 123 inmates out of 11 states. Not one of those inmates and not one of those states was Colorado or from Colorado.
Well, let me ask you a question, since you mentioned the Supreme Court's recent opinions. Justice Coates, in his concurrence and dissent, addressed this issue in terms of proportionality review. Do you think that notion has any applicability here?
In terms of proportionality review, I think the longstanding close versus people proportionality review still stands. I think Rayner was wrong on this point, and I think part of the reason it was wrong was because of its expansion of Graham. So this idea of proportionality, you look at the nature of the crime, the nature, the number of victims, and the idea, and I cited it in my brief, I think it's people versus scenarios, talks about the idea of proportionality is tied not to the defendant, but to the extreme nature of the crime itself, to how severe it is, to the underlying facts of the crime. And the trial court here clearly found those facts very extreme. It talked about it, sentencing hearing, it talked about, I credit that this defendant had a really bad childhood, but the jump from that bad childhood all the way over to murder is too big a leap to be much of a mitigator at all in this case. And so I think the proportionality review, it's still close. It's close for people, not close.
So it's a close question, is that what you're saying?
That is what I'm saying. It's still tied to one crime. Is this disproportionate? Is this sentence disproportionate to this conviction? But we have our Supreme Court now saying that life without a possibility of parole is not disproportionate for a murder conviction, even after Miller, as long as there are individualized circumstances. And of course, that doesn't apply here, because we're not even dealing with a Miller situation here, because this sentence was handed down with life with the possibility of parole after 40 years following the 2006 legislative amendments. This whole idea of children are different really needs to be read in context with the opinion and with the crime. It's not suggesting that children are different, therefore they get a free pass once they commit a number of crimes. It's, well, what were the factors that drove? I see I'm out of time. So
can you finish your sentence?
All right. So what are the factors that drove this child to commit a murder, and do they warrant a life without parole sentence? And that's the sole thing that Miller held. For that, I would ask that this court not analyze Graham as anything but a single life without parole sentence for an unsolicited offense and affirm the defendant's convictions and sentence.
Thanks, Mr. Michaels. Ms. Wagner?
I'm going to get back to my Batson issue, but I just do want to point out that it's certainly not the defense position that children who commit heinous crimes get a free pass. Rather, the question is, what is the appropriate sentence for their level of developmental ability?
Well, what do you suggest the court do if we were to remand it for resentencing? What happens to the tag on the attempted murder, the 32-year sentence? Does it just go away, or what happens to it?
It doesn't go away, Your Honor. what should happen is that the court should make an individualized determination. The court believed that it had a mandate and it was required to impose that sentence. It's not required to impose that sentence. What should happen is that that should go back to the sentencing court. The court should look at the range that is available for that sentence and make a determination as to whether or not this should be consecutive or concurrent.
So let me just make sure I understand. I think I did. So on the attempted murder, what you're saying is there's no mandatory minimum because the direct file statute should apply here, so the court has some leeway and the court needs to consider those factors and the factors that Mr. Ellis's age, all those different things. That, and then the court has to look at the total sentence. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, Your Honor. Not that, however, that there's no mandatory minimum. There is. It's that it's not mandatorily required to be imposed consecutive.
Okay. So, Ms. Wenger, I know you said you wanted to get back to the Batson issue, but I wanted to ask you about what you just said. Did I understand you to say that the alternative you're suggesting on remand is that the trial court should consider whether the 32-year sentence should be consecutive or concurrent?
No, Your Honor. I believe that it should be remanded for the court to make an individualized determination as to what the appropriate sentence would be, based on the dictates of Miller, taking into account the characteristics of Mr. Ellis, which the trial court obviously did not do, since the adult who thrust the gun into Mr. Ellis's hand and demanded that he shoot got a much lower sentence than did Mr. Ellis.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but wouldn't that sentence be at a minimum life with parole after 40?
That seems to be what Banks and Jensen are saying, that there is required to be the sentence. However, the question is what to do with this additional 32 years.
And I know your time's up, and I thought I understood, but now I'm not sure I did. Coming back to Judge Taubman's question, does the court get to make a decision whether it should be consecutive versus concurrent or no? I thought you first said the court, in your view, the court should consider whether it's consecutive, and the court has some discretion. Then when Judge Taubman asked the question, I thought you said it didn't, so I'm confused. Sorry.
My reading of the amended direct file statute is that the sentence is no longer required to be consecutive.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I think your time is up.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Magner and Mr. Michaels. We really appreciate your very fine arguments on the difficult issues presented in this case. The case will stand submitted. And a written opinion will issue in due course. That concludes your arguments this morning for Division AA, and the court will be in recess and the bailiff may so announce.